Welcome to Season 6 of Ye Olde Dragon's Library, the storytelling podcast. Each episode this season will be a chapter from the Blue Lotus Society, a book in the Guardians of the Time Stream Gas Lamp series. You might have met our heroine in the first book in the series, Odessa Fremont. S has been working as a Pinkerton agent for several years now. Her assignment, to guard a traveling Egyptian museum exhibition, puts her squarely between two powerful organizations, both of whom will stop at nothing to have the treasures and power hidden inside the artifacts. If she survives, her life will never be the same. Ready to find out what happens next? Let's begin. Chapter 2. The hissing stopped, and she felt nothing, heard nothing, smelled something chalky, not hot and acidic. A sudden wave of dizziness made her close her eyes. That didn't help. She dug her fingers into the wood and turned her head, seeking clean air. Whatever that brass thing had shot at her, it was probably a sleeping drug of some kind. Please, Granny, let it work, she thought, and dredged up the disciplines her grandmother had taught her. Matilda Fremont had firmly believed and taught that the human mind was stronger than any physical substance that might attack the body. With discipline and training, people could slow their bleeding when they were shot, muffle pain from the wounds, and speed up the rate of natural healing, including fighting off infections. S concentrated on the image of little blobby creatures moving through the river of her blood, catching the invading drug in fine nets, and dredging it from the river before it could take root in her flesh. Her heart leaped unevenly at the image of losing consciousness, then her balance, and falling from the rafters. The floor was very hard stone. The dizziness dissipated, and she dared to open her eyes. Two automatons sat perpendicular to her, all six legs on each planted on the vertical sides of the rafter beam. Perfectly still, no ticking or whirring sounds came from them, no indication of clockworks. Their eyeless pillboxes were partially retracted into their bodies. Moving slowly, ready for another spray of the chalky substance, she looked down the beam in the other direction. The two automatons there copied the same pose. So we just sit and wait until someone falls off, she thought. S hoped she would find this situation amusing in the future. Another crystalline chime sang through the air. Two automatons, one from each pair, popped their pillbox heads out, making S flinch and gasp. They climbed up the vertical beams of the rafters and tap-tapped along the roof, hanging upside down, heading for the skylight. She kept watch as much as she could while keeping the two quiescent automatons in sight. S shivered. The moonlight had faded by at least 3/4 of its intensity. How long had those things been chasing her around the warehouse rafters? Or had the clouds moved in for that predicted rainstorm? The two automatons prodded at the skylight latch. S flinched and rose up from her perch in the V when they grabbed onto the control cables for the lock and rode them down to the ground, pulling the skylight open. The two automatons still with her raised one leg each, pointing them at her. A definite threat. So, she reasoned, she could watch, turn her head to look around, but she couldn't move any other part of her body. Fine. She had a very good, unimpeded view from her perch here. So what was going to happen next? A soft, 3-note whistle warbled through the warehouse from the far door. She choked on a totally irrational giggle. The distinct hiss-clop of very large feet trying to walk noiselessly in heavy boots came through the waiting quiet. Charles was late. Fortunately, not fatally late. However, he was walking right into trouble. What in the Sam... Odessa? Charles hissed, appearing in the doorway. Where are you, girl? Are you hurt? The snick click of his Colt cocking rang loud through the warehouse. Run, she shouted. I'm trapped. She stared down a leg now pointed at her face and braced for another cloud of sleeping gas. Or maybe the acid this time. The automatons didn't have visible ears either, but they seemed to understand exactly what she was doing when she shouted. What are those things? Charles stepped out into the moonlight, staring up at her. She was touched that he was worried about her, glad he assumed she was hurt and hadn't fallen asleep on the job. But the man was an idiot. What part of run didn't he understand? Get out now! Look behind you! She dared to point. No reaction from the automatons. The automatons on the floor moved at triple the speed she had seen before. Their tap-tapping sound turned into a rattle as they skimmed across the floor, heading straight for Charles. He let out a shout and backed up, pulling his other pistol and letting go with both barrels. He missed. Charles was a crack shot. The automatons became dark brass blurs as they circled him, dodging bullets and moving in faster, until they leaped, hitting him square in the chest and taking him down. He hollered a string of curses, a string that cut off 2 seconds later with choking. S heard that hissing sound and prayed it was the chalky sleeping gas and not the acid. Charles turned onto his side, curling into a fetal ball as he gasped for air, then abruptly went limp. The two automatons went back to the controls for the skylight, leaving him lying there. S prayed he was sleeping, not dead. She closed her eyes and fought down her overactive imagination, which painted a picture of Charles inhaling acid and drowning in his own blood. That purring sound resumed. S dragged her gaze up until it caught on 4 black cables and men riding them, coming down through the skylight. The moonlight shifted, vanished, replaced by a cold, blue-tinted light that cast hard-edged shadows. Where did such light come from? No oil lamp or reflector had ever created such light. S leaned forward, trying to see up through the skylight. Another gust of the chalky gas hit her in the face. It tasted different, almost fruity, rotten fruity, like those exotic long yellow fruits her grandmother made her try on that trip to Egypt. I will not. She wiped her face and leaned back, bracing against the upright of the rafter. The dizziness faded, but it left behind a heavy, churning sensation in her belly. She couldn't see anything beyond the men coming down on the cables, with the same whirring sound the automatons made when they went up and down. She guessed an airship hovered over the warehouse. The captain had obviously waited until the moon went behind the clouds before he approached. These people were either desperate or insane. Nobody flew dirigibles down the streets of cities at night. Even a city as sprawling as Washington, with so much open space and so few buildings taller than 10 stories. It was too dangerous, too many obstructions to run into in the darkness, especially if there was any kind of industry or an academic community. People were constantly stringing all sorts of wires through the air, between buildings or sending up enormous poles, lightning rods, playing with electricity and different alloys of metal. Plus, there were the lunatics who passionately believed the surge in industrialization was a sign of the end of the world. Some of her jobs, since joining the Pinkertons, had included infiltrating groups of fearful, violent people who set themselves up as defenders of humanity. They declared themselves the judges of what level of technology was permitted, and the longer their battle, the fewer warnings they gave their targets. In large cities, people constantly climbed the highest buildings to shoot at airships to take them down. "Well, what do we have here?" a man said, his voice deep and amused. S gritted her teeth at the laughter thickening in his voice. The men gathered around Charles. One bent down and rolled him onto his back, and they searched him. "Not good," a second man spoke. "A detective." "No, that's very good," the first man said. "These people sponsoring the exhibition are finally taking the danger seriously." "Pinkertons are the best of the best," a third responded. "They'll make our job harder." "The Mobys found something. If we're lucky, that's the last of it." "Since when are we ever lucky?" the second man said. "How are his vitals?" "He's sleeping soundly and should be awakening in another hour or two with nothing worse than a headache," the first said, "and some rather odd memories." The other men snorted. S grudgingly admitted that if she weren't sitting up here in the rafters, feeling she might lose the remnants of her dinner, she would have found the thought of Charles' awakening confusion amusing. "Where are the other two?" the second man said. "Taking care of any other problems out there. Where one Pinkerton is, others are sure to follow. Let's take what we came for and leave before we have to confuse more people." The men left Charles and hurried over to the crates the automatons had separated from the others. Mobies, the men had called them. S wondered what the name had come from. They were worried about leaving before anyone else showed up. Could she do something to slow them down until the rest of her team arrived? She glanced at the automatons. Mobies. Judging from the different smells, they could change the kind of gas they used on her. Probably there was something inside them that increased the strength or even the effect of the substance whenever there was failure. How long could she keep resisting them before something succeeded in knocking her unconscious? Would she remain unconscious as she hit the floor and never feel the blow that might kill her? S had endured too much in the years since her grandparents vanished on their second expedition to South America, leaving her imprisoned in a boarding school she had fled for the sake of her sanity. She wasn't going to allow mechanical devices to end her life now in such an ignominious manner, especially with so many unanswered questions. "Excuse me?" She kicked both legs and was both pleased and chilled to find the Mobies didn't react to that particular motion, meaning they could judge what was a threatening movement. What sort of clockwork mechanisms were they to be so perceptive? Could they have people's souls trapped inside their metal bodies, or human brains directing their actions? Her grandfather had speculated about such developments, if the advancement of science and technology continued its breakneck pace, but he had said such intelligent machines were many generations in the future. "Hello?" S kicked her legs again, when only one man of the four looked around. His three companions continued digging in the crates belonging to the exhibition. "Up here!" "Found the other two Mobies," the man said, gesturing for his companions to look. "They caught a flying boy." S muffled a chuckle. "Come down, boy." "They'll just shoot me again if I move. I would prefer not to stink like rotten bananas," she added, remembering what the fruit was called. "What's that?" The first speaker stepped away from a crate. He had something long in his hand and slid the item inside his dark jacket before walking over to stand underneath S. "They gassed you?" He pulled something from his jacket pocket and put his hand to his mouth. "I think we need to talk." A high-pitched sound made her think he had a whistle. The two automatons hummed and plummeted downward on their long cables. S pulled her legs up, hauling herself up into the rafters by just her arms. She swung away toward the darkness and that ladder she wanted to reach, so desperately she could taste it. "Halt, boy!" S swallowed down a string of curses and tried to move faster. A hard thud vibrated through the rafter beam under her feet, and a yelp exploded from her. A dark shape rose up from the floor, accompanied by that purring hum, and she almost lost her grip as she saw one of the men shoot up toward the rafter in front of her. For 2 seconds, she considered trying to pull the sharp hook free. The mechanism pulling him upward moved so swiftly, the man was already there, hauling himself up to perch in front of her before she could succumb to temptation. Or was it desperation? "Well, and what's so special about you that level 1 and level 2 don't give you the sleepies, eh?" he said. S hated his arrogant pose, one foot jammed in the V of the rafter vertical, one hand holding onto the board, and his other leg and arm hanging out in empty air. At least she couldn't see his expression, though his voice certainly sounded smug. "You're just a skinny boy. Were you just taking shelter here? Or were you working with the detective down there?" She glared at him. She hated his tone of voice, even though her harmless, youthful appearance was exactly what made her so valuable and useful to the Pinkertons. She could fight with the best, unafraid to punch and kick like any boy raised in the unfriendly streets. And 2 hours later, with the help of curling tongs and a demure dress, pass herself off as a lady of quality. Dressed in boy clothes, she could convince anyone she was a boy. Forgettable, nearly invisible, no threat to anyone. If the criminals she spied on noticed her, the worst they would do was threaten her to forget what she saw and heard. But it still irked her to have this man talk to her as if she were an idiot. Shouldn't he be worried that she had been shot twice with their foul-smelling gas, and she hadn't fallen asleep like Charles? "What's wrong, boy? There's something special about you if you're unaffected. Who do you belong to?" He tugged on the cable hanging from his waist and moved along the rafter, swinging his other leg over to step into the next opening in the rafter beams. This close, S could see the crisscross of dark straps around his waist and chest, almost blending with his dark clothes, a knit jersey, dungarees, and short boots. Some kind of harness, she supposed. The swing of the cable gave her an idea. "Pinkertons," she said, and swung her legs out, holding tight to the vertical beam. The man dodged, but not fast enough. Both of her feet hit him high in the chest, knocking his breath out with a satisfying oof. Even more satisfying, he tumbled backward, over the other side of the beam. He fell a dozen feet before the shortened cable stopped him. Tangled, S kept going, down the rafter toward the wall and that ladder hidden in the shadows. She strained her ears for the purring of those cable mechanisms. The man behind her laughed as he struggled up onto the beam. S spat, wanting to curse. She could like him under other circumstances. That purring hum came from in front of her, and S faltered. Where was it? That blue-white light cast such odd shadows, and then cut off with such sharp lines. She muffled a sob of relief as she stepped into shadows. Just a few more feet, and that ladder would be within her grasp. Once she was down the ground, no one would be able to catch her. "Men can be so blind, don't you agree?" a woman said from the darkness in front of her, her voice smooth and alto low. S lost her footing and scrabbled at the rafter beam. Rough wood scraped at her cheek. The nauseous ball in her gut expanded and threatened to send tentacles up her throat. She smelled sulfur and heard a hiss. Light exploded in her eyes, softening a moment later into a flame on the end of a match. It illuminated a woman with dark hair caught up in a long braid. She stood at the top of that ladder nailed to the wall. She held the match out toward S with her other hand hooked around the top rung of the ladder. The light didn't go out in a few seconds, like other matches. "I'm guessing you're partnered with the man down on the floor," the woman continued. "Clever, disguising a woman as a boy. People only see what they expect to see, or they're trained to see." She tipped her head to one side and narrowed her eyes, looking S up and down a few times. "Our inside man says the Pinkertons have an upper-crust lady archaeologist hosting the gala opening tomorrow night. I'm guessing that's supposed to be you." She sighed. "Or rather, that was supposed to be you. Very sorry." "Are you going to kill me?" S pressed one hand over her heart when it sped up, pressing with almost painful intensity against her breastbone. Did she dare draw her derringer? Would she have time? "Hardly. Someone immune to the first two levels of tranquilizer gas has quite a lot to offer." Her gaze flickered up to land beyond S's shoulder. "We're just going to introduce you to Zeus." "What's—" S flinched as a thin, hard cord wrapped around her waist. She turned to find the man she had knocked off the rafter, perched only a few feet behind her now. "Distractions," she scolded herself. "Avoid distractions." "This is Zeus," the man said, smiling crookedly at her. "Stings a little." He brought up a pistol, but the barrel was solid with several different colors of wire wrapped around it. Sparks spun around inside the barrel, revealing it was some dark glass. The sparks shot out, filling S's eyes. She felt her legs fold, just before blackness picked her up and spun her around. At least the nausea was gone. Then everything was gone. "Athena." The thoughtful note in Dr. Sylvia's voice raised the hairs on the back of Athena Latimer's neck. The ship's doctor for the airship, Golden Nile, couldn't possibly have found anything so early in her examination of the girl disguised as a boy, unless it was a very large, significant something. Athena stood up slowly from the bench that circled the perimeter of the narrow room and crossed the waiting area outside of sickbay. She had listened to that sense of warning she considered a gift from God and had stayed here to wait for the results of the examination instead of going to the conference room where she did most of her work. The artifacts the Mobys had detected in the exhibition crates needed testing to verify they were indeed parts of the great machine. The sooner she tested them, the sooner the airship could move on, away from Washington, in pursuit of other artifacts scattered throughout the country. This ridiculous passion for all things Egyptian had spread from Britain to the United States, In the wake of the renewed, peaceful negotiations after the war, Athena could almost have hoped that the bitter feelings the government harbored for Britain and Queen Victoria, because of her support of the South during the Civil War, could have remained strong. It made life so much simpler. The resources of the originators were stretched thin as it was, testing artifacts in Britain and Egypt, but now the area of search had doubled. Those concerns had to wait until she resolved the mystery of this girl who resisted the tranquilizer gases. "Look at this." Dr. Sylvia beckoned, and Athena stepped up to the examination table, one of four built into the metal deck of the airship. The older woman's long, dexterous fingers tucked up the tightly braided and pinned hair at the nape of the mystery girl's neck. It had been covered by a cap until she fell, stunned by the Zeus gun, then stopped short, caught by Theo's safety cable. The sudden jerk of arrested free fall had knocked the cap loose, despite the pins holding it tightly in place. The hair pushed aside now revealed a faded blue and green tattoo. "No," Athena whispered, even as a light, cool feeling spread through her chest. She blinked away tears, looking at the blue lotus tattoo. Her ankle. She should have another on the ball of her right ankle. Simon, Sylvia's nephew and apprentice healer, hurried to peel off the girl's battered boots and thick socks, revealing narrow, calloused feet, still pretty with their high arches, but showing signs of hard use. On the bulge of bone on the outside of her right ankle, another blue lotus. "Vivian's girl, you think?" Sylvia whispered. "Who else could it be?" Athena's thoughts raced. "There's no way the revisionists could know we would come here before the tour even started. How could they plant someone to work among the Pinkertons to guard the artifacts?" "I make it a point never to underestimate people who would try to erase the very existence of the Savior," Theo said from the doorway, where he had kept watch ever since he carried the girl into the sickbay. "But would they go so far to try to fool us into thinking Vivian and Edward's daughter is still alive?" "We have to test her," she said, staring down at the unconscious girl. That pale face, lightly smudged with dirt. Did it look like Vivian and Edward, or even Matilda? "Merciful God in heaven, if you have answered our prayers, we thank you. And if you haven't," Theo said, his voice turning hard, "have mercy on our souls for what we will have to do to protect all of eternity." We hope you enjoyed today's chapter. For more information on all the books and series featured in this podcast, or to purchase the ebook or audiobook for future reading and listening pleasure, please visit yeolddragonbooks.com. You can also find more information about our books and purchase ebooks on our Patreon page, Ye Old Dragons Library. Please consider supporting the podcast to gain access to free stories or discounts, or a chance to purchase a new book in advance of release. Thanks for listening to this episode of Ye Old Dragons Library.